One of the reasons I wanted to record these new conversations for the show is because I'd finally have the chance to speak to some guests that I'd always been a very big fan of, and tonight is certainly no exception. Mike Harris has been investigating the Amelia Earhart case for decades, and his research has laid the foundation for others to further their own. For that reason alone, I'm a big fan, and you should be too. After years of doing this show, finally, one of the most celebrated and iconic researchers in the entirety of this case sits down with me to discuss his lifelong desire to prove that Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan were indeed captured by the Japanese. This is Mike Harris. Mike, I just told you off the record. I will tell you on the record, this is an honor. Thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate it.
I'm glad to be here. Hope I have something to add.
I'm sure you do. Let's start this out tonight by talking a little bit about some of the work you've done. You've written a couple of books on Amelia Earhart. One of those books is called Amelia Earhart Lost Star, and you wrote it for younger audiences. It reads for younger audiences, sort of skews towards a younger audience. I think there's something really wise in that decision. Tell me why you did that.
I didn't know it was for a younger audience. Yeah, I've written two books on Amelia Earhart, and then recently a Hollywood writer, Peter Crabb, who wrote the Car 54, Where Are You, if you remember that TV program, and was McLean's
sure.
Navy, he did that one as well. He liked the research that I had, and he recently took the book that I wrote on Amelia Earhart and changed the title to Spy. So that's the one we're interested in getting done as a film, and also as in the book, I went ahead and wrote a book about the screenplay, but I added all my research, Amelia Earhart research, so I'm hoping to do something with that someday. So anyway, but the first one I wrote was, I don't remember the name of it, Amelia Earhart, The Final Flight, I think.
Yeah.
And then somebody had an idea, the Lost Star was made up, and I wrote took his story and wrote a book about it, but it's a very interesting story, although it's not true, but it's a story. The other one I wrote about Final Flight is based on my historical research.
Well, I want to take a moment to read the foreword, if it's okay with you, from the book Amelia Earhart, Lost Star, because I think it's pretty incredible. And I'm going to quote this. So, quote, "There are seven stars in the constellation Pilates. Six can be seen with the naked eye, but the seventh remains hidden and has become known as the Lost Star. Amelia Earhart has become known as America's Lost Star. While flying around the world in 1937, she disappeared, her whereabouts unknown, and a matter of great speculation. Isn't it ironic that the plane Amelia was flying when she disappeared was named Electra? As most astronomers know, that lost star of Pilates is also named Electra." Pretty amazing. I love that.
Well, I thought it was amazing as well. So, yeah, it was Electra, and we found parts of it over on Mealy. So we can talk about that if you want to.
Yes, getting to that, let's move forward. You go back a long time in this case, and I know that you know that, and I know that, but for the people that will be hearing this for the first time that will not know, because we have a lot of those new people, tell me the origin of your involvement in this case.
Well, you could almost blame it on Mickey Rooney, the movie star.
Right.
Do you remember Mickey Rooney?
Sure.
I was I was executive director. I graduated from University of Florida with a degree in radio TV advertising, and I got involved when I got out of the Marine Corps as an officer. I went to work for an advertising agency, and then I got tired of making television commercials and that sort of thing. I was the executive director of the American Bowl in Tampa. It's now called the Outback Bowl, but I started it as the American Bowl. Well, after 6 or 7 years of doing that, I thought, well, I don't want to do football stuff. I want to get involved in doing movies and so forth. And I heard that Mickey Rooney, the famous Hollywood actor, was living in Tampa, grew up in Tampa. He was living then in Fort Lauderdale, married to his wife number six or something. And so I figured out how to get over to see him. And he had a movie script about a gambler. And I thought he was a great actor. And wow, I could do a movie on a gambler in Tampa. That was great. So it cost $250,000. Well, when I was doing the bowl game, a fellow named Bob Dudley was head of the Meeker Corporation that did all the television for me, put me on national television every year. So I went up to New York to see Bob Dudley, see if he could help me raise the $250,000 so I could do this movie with Mickey Rooney. I told him all about the Mickey Rooney and so forth. And so surprisingly, he wrote me a check for $250,000. I got on a plane, flew back to Tampa, all excited. Mickey, I found, got the $250,000, we're going to do that movie. Oh, Uncle Mike, he said, I sold that screenplay to somebody else. And we can do a Western. He started pitching me on this Western. I said, Mickey, let me, I got to get back to you on that. So I couldn't do a Western in Tampa. So I flew back up to New York City to see Bob Dudley, told him what happened, handed him back the check. Surprisingly, he gave me back the check. He said, what do you want to do next? He said, I wasn't betting on Mickey Rooney. I was betting on you. I was really shocked. So I had to think real quick. And I had done some research recently about Bikini, where they had all the atom bomb tests after World War II. And I told him there were mutated sharks and radiation and that sort of thing. And he said, well, I can put that on television. Go do your movie. So he ended up doing that movie with Rod Serling. It won a silver medal at the Atlanta International Film Festival. I hadn't planned on doing documentaries, but, you know, I thought, well, I'm gonna do the Titanic. I'd love to do the Titanic. Then I found out the Titanic's at 12,500 feet. And what I'd done at Bikini was at 200 feet. There's a big difference. So I really didn't have the experience and know-how how to do that. So I got involved trying to find Noah's Ark on Mount Ararat in Turkey, did a film with Joseph Cotton, and then Treasure in Mexico with Pancho Villa's Treasure with Cesar Romero. And then I had enough publicity, I had enough experience where I could get it funded. And I got an oil guy in Texas to fund my first expeditions on the Titanic. So I did the first one in 1980 and did a film with Orson Welles, Search for the Titanic. And then in 81, Jim Drury, who played the Virginian on television, he actually went with me on my second expedition. So after doing two of those in 1983, I decided that I wanted to go to the Marshall Islands and to try and see if I can find Emil Earhart. Well, since I had been to the Marshall Islands and in the early 70s, when I did my first film with Rod Serling called Deadly Fathoms, they won an award and so forth. And I knew the fellow that ran the Marshall Islands. Back then, it was a trust territory. Yeah. Marshall Islands were a trust territory. And the first secretary, the man who ran it, was a fellow named Oscar de Broom. So I went to see Oscar with a film team and so forth to see if I could find out anything about Emil Earhart. And he said, Mike, he said, why don't you go on the radio? He said, I'll arrange for you to go on the Marshall Islands radio, and then you can ask people at all over the islands if they have any information on Emil Earhart to come to Majuro and talk to you, and you can film them and so forth.
Yeah.
That's what happened. After a few days, I came back to my hotel, a little motel, really. And this fellow was sitting on his haunches named Lotan Jack. He had a story about Emil Earhart. So I said, wow, that's wonderful. So I put him up in front of a palm tree. And I want to tell this for sure, that whenever I interview anybody, I set up the camera and the lights. Say, wait a minute, hang on. Let me set up the camera. Let me set up the lights and so forth. Then I'll get ready. And when I'm ready, I'll let you start talking. So I do that. And I let them talk. I don't interrupt them. I don't want to ask them questions and try and get them to say what I want them to say. I only film what they say with no encouragement, good or bad, from me, you know. So
yeah.
So that's what I did with Lotan Jack. Let me tell you what he said exactly. It's very interesting. He said, my name is Lotan Jack. He said, I was working with the Japanese people on Jalawet Island as a coffee maker for the high-ranking officer on Nimitz Island. It's about 8 miles from Jalawet Japanese headquarters. During that time, we heard the stories about Amelia Earhart from Japanese naval officer. They said airplane was shot down between Mili and Jalawet. It's about 30 miles from Mili. And one Japanese ship was found her and pick her up and took her to Mili Atoll. And from Mili Atoll, they took her to Jalawet. After Jalawet, they took her to Kwajalein. And last time, they sent her to Saipan. And the Japanese naval officer told all the Marshallese not to talk about her because there were kind of secret words about her. They said she was flying around the world that she was spying for the American people. Now, when he said she was shot down, I didn't believe him. But I didn't, like I told you, I didn't interrupt. I just record and film whatever they say. A day or two later, Oscar de Broom, the first secretary who ran the Marshall Islands for the United States government, he said, Mike, he said, I've got a story about Amelia Earhart as well. I said, Oscar, you do that's terrific. He said, I can't do anything during the day. I'm busy in the government offices running the country. But if you can film me tonight, I'll come by. I did film him. He said, my name is Oscar de Broom. He said, I'm with the government of the Marshall Islands as the first secretary. I remember distinctly when I used to go to school in Jalouette, Marshall Islands, about 1937, when my father came home and informed us that an American lady pilot had been captured and that she was being taken to the Japanese office and that people were not permitted to go close to her or even come anywhere near to where she was being captured and taken into office. He did not say how long she was, whether he saw her or not, but the information he passed along to the family was that, and I recall that distinctly, that an American lady had been captured and that she was taken to the high command's office in Jalouette, and this was in 1937. Now, Oscar de Broom was graduated from University of Hawaii, so he was a smart guy, and he was running all of the Marshall Islands for the U.S. government. Had no reason to lie or make up any story. Obviously, I don't pay anybody. All I do is film people and get their information, what they say. So you want to hear one more?
Yeah, let's hear it.
This is Billerman Amaron. He was living on Majuro, but here's what Billerman told me. Sometime during the summer of 1937, we were called out to one of the Japanese cargo ships. I was then working as a health aide to the Japanese civilian doctor on Jalouette Atoll. We went together to the ship, and we saw a white man who was wounded right in front of his head and also his leg, and there was a female with him wearing trousers like a man and a shirt with a scarf. She was between 5 and 6 feet long. The crew of the ship said they picked them up off Mili Atoll. He went on to say, I personally treated the man's wounds. The wound on the front of his head was not very serious, but around the knee was kind of a 4-inch cut infected. I put Paraplay on the knee. The head wound only required a bandage. I saw the lady, but was not allowed to talk to her. I heard the Japanese call Amira, Amira. So whether it is Amelia Earhart or not, I think it is. It was 1937. So that was very, very interesting. I also filmed a few other people that said they were rushed out of bed at night and had to go to a ship and load coal on the ship because it was going out. They said that they secretly said they weren't supposed to talk about it, but they were going to that American lady and their pilot and their navigator had landed over at Mili and they were going to pick them up. So, well, I went to Saipan. When I went over to Saipan, I met a fellow named Manny Munyo. He was a senator at one time, but before that, he was a harbor pilot. You know, when a big freight or steamship comes in, the harbor pilot has to lead him safely into the harbor.
Yeah.
Said he was on the deck of a Japanese freighter. Anyway, here's what he said. My name is Manuel Munoz. One morning when I was on board the Fuku Maru, the captain of the Fuku Maru informing me when the plane was circling around, it was a Beechcraft type aircraft. He told me that when he was on the deck with his captain, a silver plane, twin engine plane, was flying around overhead. And that's why he's telling me this story. He said it was a Beechcraft type aircraft. And he remembered in 1937 when he was ordered to shoot down the plane. And when the plane was shot down, he learned the pilot on the plane was a man and a girl. Then later on, he found out that the pilot and the navigator was Amelia Earhart and Fred Newman. Later, they were taken down to the island of Jalouette in the Marshall Islands, and they were taken further to Saipan for further interrogation, where the Japanese Imperial headquarters were located in 1937. Well, when Manny Munoz said that, I about fell down because I thought Lotan Jack said she was shot down. I thought he just misspoke, you know. But then here it is, over 1,000 miles away on Saipan, and Manny Munoz course, is talking to the captain of the Fukumaru, who said he shot her down. So that was very interesting. So I was able to visit Amelia herself on Saipan, and I tried to dig around a little bit in the bottom, you know, to see if I could find anything. But I didn't do a good job, so it was just a waste of time. Mm. When I was on Saipan, I also had a meeting with this lady, Miss Bloss.
Yeah.
Now, Miss Bloss has an interesting story, and I got her and her granddaughter. Had to use the granddaughter because she taught English in the local high school there, and Miss Bloss didn't speak English, so it was kind of interesting. Miss Bloss would talk in the Saipanese language and so forth, and then the granddaughter, this is what granddaughter said. She said she saw Amelia riding in a motorcycle sidecar with a blindfold and handcuffs on her hand, and these two guards on the side of Amelia, and they take her down to the place where they're going to kill her, and they shot her right straight on the chest, and then she fell back to the grave. She says she knows the place where they kill Amelia because she left the place, and then she went back to make sure they buried the body there, and she went back and checked on it. She found they buried her under that breadfruit tree. That was her mark. Well, I got 6 months later, I got permission to go back and dig under the breadfruit tree, and I did find a blindfold that Mrs. Bloss said she saw Amelia wearing. It was on the edge of a Japanese naval base, okay, where the Kawanishi flying boat flew in and out of Saipan. And so I didn't understand, well, how could somebody like Mrs. Bloss, who was a child at the time, how could she have permission to go on this Japanese naval base, you know?
Right.
And she explained that her family, there was a hillside, and her family grew some crops, whatever it was that they grew on the hillside, and they were able to tend the crops and go there. And when she was there, she looked down and she could see what was happening. You know, I was looking at the place where they had the blindfold, where she found the blindfold, the breadfruit tree and so forth. And she could have seen something. It was about 50 yards away. So she could have seen it as a little girl, somebody blindfolded and shot in the chest. But I think, and I'm sure with your research and what other people have said, as you know, before the Marines attacked Saipan in June of 1944, they had airplanes that flew over and took pictures and so forth and doing reconnaissance before the invasion, and some of these pilots were shot down, and it is a record that they were shot down. And so I think, and then that they were, some were killed, some died when they were shot down, and others were killed. I think she probably saw one of these pilots being shot down, and then over the years people talking about Amelia Earhart, and in her mind she thought, well, maybe that was Amelia Earhart I saw, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't think she was trying to lie. She was trying to, wasn't paying her any money, didn't give her anything. But I just think she, it would be great if the blindfold that I have in my office now was her blindfold. In fact, I did have a friend of mine, a Marine major, I was trying to think of his name, in Quantico, Virginia. He had the FBI test the blindfold, but it came back negative. They didn't get anything off of it. But I think actually that Mrs. Bloss just kind of made up that story in her mind, you know, over the years, and thought she saw Amelia Earhart. I'm not sure that she did.
Yeah.
But anyway, to go on with my Amelia Earhart stories, I became friends with a fellow named Richard Martini. Have you ever interviewed Richard Martini?
Not yet. I've requested a couple of times. We'll see if he says yes.
Yeah, I think I gave you his name several years ago. Well, Rich and I went over to Saipan and we filmed some more people, and there's lots and lots of people that we filmed in the Marshall Islands and on the, he wasn't with me in the Marshall Islands, but then I took him with me to Saipan on another trip, and we filmed lots of other people. But what's interesting about Rich Martini, he's a filmmaker in Santa Monica, California, and he, on his own, I didn't have anything to do with it, but he filmed a fellow named Julius Neighbors, who was involved. He was a Marine that took part in the invasion of Saipan in 1944. And Julius Neighbors was a wire operator for Colonel Wallace, the commanding officer of the unit on Saipan in 1944. He decoded a message that said Amelia Earhart's plane has been found at Oslito Airfield. And that's where her plane was. Well, Julius Neighbors said that he was ordered to stand guard at the Electra when it was sitting out in the open, then again after it was placed in a locked hangar. He said when Navy brass came to see the plane, he refused them entry because orders is orders. Neighbor said another message came in several weeks later saying, we're going to destroy Emil Earhart's plane. He and two of his Marine buddies watched other Marines destroy the plane. So that's Julius Neighbors, what Rich Martini has on film for Julius Neighbors. Another one was a fellow named Robert Wallach. Robert Wallach said when Marines attacked Saipan in 1944, Robert Wallach and several buddies found a safe inside an abandoned church. They blew the door off with explosives. When the smoke cleared, Robert grabbed a briefcase inside, thinking it was full of money. And when he opened it, he discovered the logbooks, maps, visas, and personal papers of Emil Earhart. And Robert kept the briefcase for almost a week until his buddy said he should turn it over to a naval officer, which he did. Here's the picture of Amelia with her briefcase.
Yeah.
And when Robert Wallach saw that picture, he said that's exactly the briefcase that they found on Saipan. And when he got a receipt for it when he turned it over to the Navy officer, but he was not injured during the fighting on Saipan. Several months later, when he was on another island, I'm not sure which one it was, he was severely wounded, and the receipt that he kept in his pocket, his pants got cut away, and he lost the receipt. So he did not have the receipt, but all he had was what he swears happened, and I'm sure that's what happened. Now, another fellow, Thomas Devine, a lot of people have stories about Thomas Devine. Martini filmed him, and he was a postal worker on Saipan in 44 and witnessed Julius Neighbors guarding Emil Earhart's Lockheed Electra and had him order away Navy brass. He wanted to get into the locked hangar and see the historic aircraft. Thomas also inspected Emil Earhart's cell at Saipan, the same one I went in that I showed you a picture of, where he was told she was a prisoner for over 5 years. It's interesting to know that that she and Fred Noonan must have been there for years, but when the Japanese learned that the Marines were going to attack in 44, they died. Now, whether they got shot and killed, a lot of people think, and there have been stories that Fred Noonan's head was cut off, and that's probably true. How Amelia died, I have not been able to find, I haven't found anybody else that definitively can say how she died. I think personally that she died of dysentery, because when she was on her flight over on Africa, she caught dysentery, and that's proven, and that she was sick while she was in prison. And I think she eventually died of dysentery before the Marines attacked on Saipan, but that's not 100%. We don't know for sure. And anyway, there's a couple other people that saw her on Saipan, and also Julius Neighbors, the same one, the radio operator that knew that it was going to be destroyed. Amelia's plane was ordered to be destroyed. Then he got in a Jeep, and he and his couple buddies watched it being towed out on the runway. To the end of the runway, he watched his Marines got on the plane and poured 5 cans of gasoline and lit it on fire. It burned it up. Then a bulldozer came and flattened whatever was left and then pushed it in a big hole with a lot of other war stuff, you know, guns and whatever, you know, so
yeah.
Other planes and trucks and stuff. So we think that's where it still is off the end of that runway. I'd like to go back there and dig. However, research that I've done also, I know that in that same pile of wrecked World War II metal and so forth from 44. Somebody from the Philippines got permission to go in there and dig and get a lot of the metal out just to sell it, you know, as it was scrap metal.
Yeah.
Whether Emil Earhart's plane was part of that or whether it wasn't, we don't know for sure. So we think we can get in there and at least check and see if there's anything left there and to find her aluminum plane. So
I want to ask you something that might be considered to be a controversial question. You've excavated sites in Saipan. You just talked a little bit about that. Sites that, you know, are thought to be maybe the final resting place of Earhart. Is there anything inside you that hopes this wasn't how her life ended? Or do you just have to come to peace as an investigator with the idea that this wasn't pretty and the world should know?
No, I think absolutely that she did go down at Mealy, and we can talk about that in a minute.
Yeah.
And she was taken to Saipan, and she spent her time in prison. We have so many people that saw her being transported in a truck. So many people, I forget the name of the hotel that she was in on the second floor and the ground floor. It was the Japanese police. Many eyewitnesses saw her on the second floor and walking to the public bathroom. But anyway, there's a lot of stories of her being on Saipan. I think she did die of dysentery, and some of the stories of people saying that she had to go to the bathroom quite often in the public bathroom and went right by their house and talked to a little girl and helped her with her schoolwork and that sort of thing. So I think that's all true. And she was there, and I think she did die on Saipan. And it's a terrible ending, but it's absolutely for sure. I mean, I believe 100% that she did not just disappear in the ocean, and that's what happened to her. She and Fred Noonan did end up on Saipan, and that's what happened to her.
Tell me about your time on Millie, and then I want to ask you about working with Buddy Brennan, but we'll get to Buddy in a minute. Just tell me a little bit about your time on Millie and what you did there.
Well, in 2015, that was the last time that I've been over in that area of the world. I raised some money from Parker Aerospace in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about Parker Aerospace, they provided some of the instruments that were on her plane. That's why they agreed to fund my expedition to go over there and see if we can find her plane and find some of the instruments that they provided on the Lockheed 10E.
10 Electra E, yeah, that's right.
So we went over there, had professional people with metal detectors and so forth. And here's the newspaper article when we arrived in 2015.
Yeah.
Had a picture taken with President Chris Loewick, because we had to get permission from him to go to Mealy and then actually recover some of these artifacts and then bring them back to Majuro so he could see them and so forth. But one of the fellows that I took with me, Dick Spink, have you interviewed Dick Spink?
Dick Spink is a lovely guy. Yes, he's a friend.
Yeah, and you know that he found the two things over there on Saipan, and so that's why we were able to go back to the exact island where Amelia Earhart did land with this extra equipment and found extra things that Dick Spink didn't find. But he was with us as well. Was Les Kinney, but another fellow was—he was an expert on Amelia Earhart's plane. Well, as you probably know, when Jim was a boy, his son took him to meet with Paul Mance. Did you know that?
I did know that. I did hear that. Yes.
And he was able to look at some of the maps, the exact maps that Amelia Earhart had on her flight and so forth. And Jim actually flew in the route that she took when going over Africa and that sort of thing. So, but he's an expert, as you know, on that model plane and what parts that we found. He was able to find an exact model in a museum of her plane, a real size plane, and compare what we found against the parts on the plane. They fit perfectly. So we know it came from her plane. Anyway, it didn't have her name on it, so they can't prove it.
Yeah.
But anyway, we did go over there with metal detectors, and what was very interesting, and maybe Dick Spink has told you the same thing. These are not big islands, and so there was a small island to the right, and we used metal detector. We didn't find anything on that. Another little island on the left of this island, we used the metal detectors, didn't find anything whatsoever. On this one island where we found things, we didn't find anything except this one section about 40, 50 feet long, wide, I mean, where they cut down trees and so forth that then dragged her plane off the reef and across one end of the island and put it on an island barge and took it out to the Japanese ship called the Koshu Maru. So we have the logbooks of the Koshu Maru to prove this, what was there at that time and so forth. And Les Kinney found, through the Freedom of Information Act, he found a picture that showed Amelia and Fred on a dock at Jalouette and with the Koshu Maru in the harbor towing a plane on the stern.
Yeah.
Some people tried to say, oh, no, that's not true. That blah, blah, blah. They're not right. We actually proved that dock was built and was there. It was built in 1936, so new in 36, and the Marshallese government gave us that information and that it was there and she was there, and that's her picture there, and that's the Koshu Maru with the plane at the stern.
Yeah.
So what we found was the only two basic things that really were significant was a hand-rolled piece of aluminum. It turns out that Lockheed only hand rolled by hand up until 1939. They did not hand roll it after that. Well, Amelia's plane was built during 35 and 36. So it had to come off a plane, you know, at that era.
Yeah.
All the World War II Japanese World War II planes, and there was an air base at Mealy. Well, at Injikan, this little island where we found all these metal pieces, it's about 30 or 40 miles away across the lagoon.
Mm.
It wasn't anywhere even close to this airfield. But when we found these pieces, some were inspection plates, and the other was a rolled piece of aluminum. took everybody over to Mealy's. We could wanted to get samples of a World War II Japanese aircraft, so forth. And so we did get some samples of the aluminum from a Japanese Zero, a Japanese Val, and a Japanese Betty Bomber. Yeah, the three of them. And we took those with what we found and took them back to Parker Aerospace in Cleveland. And their scientists did the whatever they do to do the molecular study of the different types of metals and so forth, and found out that the metal that we found at Inchiquin, 30 miles away, was different than the World War II aluminum made by the Japanese and in the aircraft that we found on Mealy. And Jim took it to one of the actual model of the plane, and it fit perfectly on the tail assembly of the and so did Dick Spink's dust cover that he found and so forth, and the piece of aluminum and the inspection plates. They all fit perfectly on the tail assembly, the real tail assembly, we thought, and Dick did, and Jim did too, that it was off the main gear, but it turned out no, it came off the tail wheels assembly.
Yeah,
but when I went over to Mealy, I met with the Eroach. And the Eroach he's the king. And in the martial language, he's called an Eroach. I knew he was too young. I said, did he have any stories about Emile Earhart? He said, in 1937, he said his grandfather was the Eroach of Mealy. Mm. And his grandfather told him that the Japanese came around and they made him go around to the other islands and collect 40 of the strongest men and boys he could find so he could bring them back to the Inchiquin, 40 miles away, and drag this heavy Lockheed Electra off the reef and across one end of the island so they could put it on the barge and then take it out to the Koshumaru.
Yeah.
He said how they did that was on Mealy, there was a narrow gauge railroad. Now, I was familiar with the narrow gauge railroad because when I did my first expedition in 1972, we went to Bikini. Before we went to Bikini, we went to an island called Wochi. And on Wochi, they had a narrow gauge railroad because it would go around and it would collect coconuts and things. And that's what the Marshallese sold, was coconuts, you know, oil and coconuts and so forth. That's how they made money. Mm. Well, they did the same thing on Mealy because it was a big enough island that they could make a living harvesting these coconuts, you know. So
yeah.
There was not any there weren't that many coconut palms on the end of the islands 40 miles away, but only on Mealy. So there was a narrow gauge railroad. We said, well, the Japanese took some of the couple of the railroad rails and made took some of the wheels. They put the wheels for the left wheel, the right wheel, and the tail wheel. They had three of them, and they would move it slowly off with the Japanese soldiers and all these Marshallese from Mealy.
Yeah.
They would lift it up and they'd roll it a little bit, and then they'd take one of the rails and push it forward, and then they'd roll it a little bit further and take the rail from behind and push it forward till they could finally get it off the reef, cross that one end of the island, and that's the only place where we found any metal whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And onto this barge and onto the Koshumaru. And like I said, Les Kinney found that they accidentally sent it to him by mistake, the picture of Amelia and Fred on at the dock at Mealy. I mean at Jalawit.
Right.
We know that's what happened, and she ended up on Saipan, and they both died on Saipan. So anyway, that's my story.
You've talked about tonight a lot of people, a lot of really well-known researchers, people that are listening to this show or will listen to it will know the names. There's another name I want to ask you about. You worked with him early, but tell me about working with Buddy Brennan. What was that experience like? Tell us a little bit about Buddy, because a lot of people in the Earhart research legacy and people that are getting into it will come across his name often.
Well, when I did my film Search for the Titanic with Orson Welles, is funded by Jack Grimm in Abilene, Texas. Mm. So we had a grand opening, or whatever you call it, premiere of the film at Abilene, in the movie theaters in Abilene. And Buddy Brennan showed up. And so I never met him. I mean, I didn't know him. And he wanted to know what I was going to do next. And I said, well, I was really wanted to try and find out what happened to Emile Earhart. And so he said, well, could he do anything to help get involved and so forth, which he did. And I took him over with me on that first trip when I had a film team with Oscar de Broom and Lotan Jack and Billiman Amaron and so forth. And so I took Buddy with me, and then we went over and film people over there on Saipan and so forth. So they were all of my all of my contacts and all of my film team and all of my filming and so forth. And then years later, Buddy wanted to know, he said, they got somebody there to help him write this book about Amelia Earhart. Mm-hmm. They wanted to know, could he use my pictures and things like that? I said, sure, that'd be fine. And so we put one of the pictures in there of me, one or two or several of my guests of work. Mm-hmm. But because he wrote that book and had it published, everybody believed that Buddy Brennan was the one that did all this research on Amelia Earhart, and all the research that I've done, nobody's heard about it, or nobody gives me any credit.
Yeah.
Buddy was a good friend. I mean, I don't want to say anything bad about Buddy, but Buddy ended up getting all the publicity for everything that I had done, and that the people in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, yeah, they're the ones that helped him write the book, and I gave him let him use the pictures with Oscar the Broom and Lotan Jack and all that sort of thing. But anyway, that's how it happened with Buddy Brennan. So.
All right. Well, I've got one last question for you tonight, and then we'll get out of your way. And it's more of a personal thought, personal opinion. If it is indeed discovered, and I know you guys have done a lot of work on this, but if Amelia and Fred were captured by the Japanese and did in fact die in their custody in any way, shape or form, what would you like to see happen as a result of that discovery or declaration or whatever you want to call it? What do you want to see happen next if they confirm that, for lack of a better term?
Well, you know, I started off telling you about Peter Crabb wrote this wonderful screenplay called The Spy, The Untold Story of Amelia Earhart. It is based on my research. And so we do point out, and we do have it in the screenplay, that, you know, she was captured and so forth. But the reason that she wasn't rescued or anything, our research believes, and other people's research also, that the U.S. had broken the Japanese code and that we knew what the Japanese were doing. And if we had told the Japanese, now, we know you've got her and we know she's over on Saipan, then we would have lost all of that intelligence advantage. And so the Japanese also, we think it was a rogue person on Saipan, maybe that ordered her to be shot down.
Yeah.
Japanese didn't want to let everybody know that they had shot down America's sweetheart or Lady Lindy, and the U.S. didn't want to let Japanese know we knew where she was. She was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and so the only thing that the U.S. government did was say, okay, well, she was lost at sea. We'll search. We'll go out there, went out with the Colorado and with planes, and search area off Nicomororo, as Rich Gillespie has been doing for years and years, and there's not one eyewitness that says she's landed at Nicomororo. She did not land there. And all the things that he claims that he found, and nobody's ever found anything there because she never went that way. When the captain of the Itasca was looking for her, he requested from the government that he go look to the west in the direction of the Marshall Islands. And there was a huge storm there, and there was no storm whatsoever when she was supposed to land there at the Howland. The weather was clear and it was perfect, but there was a huge storm to the west, and they did all their searching to the east and around Nicomororo and didn't find anything. The government wouldn't let him work the Marshall Islands because the Japanese wouldn't let him do it. So we're sure that's what happened, and that's where she ended up, and the U.S. had to say she died at sea. Well, I think, you know, on the, I speculate, I don't know. I just kind of hope that in the CIA headquarters where they have stars for the people that have been lost and so forth, I hope that first star there is Amelia Earhart. They don't say who the stars represent. They're agents that have been lost and so forth. And I don't know that. I just speculate and hope that first star really should belong to Amelia Earhart, because she was one of the first casualties of World War II, really. So she was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Well, Mike, this has been a pleasure. It's been something I've been wanting to do for a long time. Thank you for sitting down with me tonight, giving me a little snapshot of your amazing career in this case and what you've done. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Hope you learned something.
This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chasing Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each new episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/ChasingEarhart, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @ChasingEarhart. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your editor and host for Chasing Earhart is me, Chris Williamson. The show is produced by my wife, Vanessa Williamson, with music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in the podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Chasing Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Chasing Earhart is a Madhouse Films production. Copyright 2022. All rights reserved.